that this plan has always existed, that life is fulfilling a plan, that growth is ordered, that things are growing from something to something, that all growth is leading in a direction predestined and foreordained before the beginning of the world, to use a good old scriptural term. Therefore, that there is somewhere a final, inevitable group of realities. These realities, known or unknown, recognized or unrecognized, acknowledged or denied, remain the same. Nothing changes them. Man may shake his fist at them forever, but he does not diminish them in any way. The individual may live many lives without knowing that they exist, but nevertheless they exist within him and he in them from the beginning. The concept of archetype would assume, therefore, that in the mind of God, reality is a fact, that reality exists. Therefore, that in the nature of mind of God abides what we would call absolute knowledge. Now, this is absolute knowledge to the degree that we recognize deity as absolute life. If we recognize deity as a conditioned existence, then we must recognize the knowledge possessed by deity as a conditioned knowledge. But up to the present time, we have never reached a point where we dared to speculate too greatly on this final problem. We have to assume that for us, absolute knowledge is the full and complete knowing of the universal plan or purpose for which we were intended and for which the universe was created, and toward which both ourselves and the universe are moving inevitably. The moment we acknowledge or accept the fact of a universal, all-including and all-inclusive plan, we then contemplate on what we can know about it. And then epistemology posits the next question. A man is a conditioned creature. He exists with a certain group of faculties. He exists with a certain mental development. This differs somewhat in all persons. But the whole gamut of it, as manifested on this planet by human beings, is a comparatively narrow field. If we divide or create a concept covering the knowledge of the person who knows the least of all men, and the person who knows the most of all men, we are still within a comparatively narrow limit of knowledge. That the human being, then, if he is a conditioned being in the process of moving from a present state to a better state, it is assumed that the knowledge that he can possess now is the knowledge of his present state, or at his present state. And that if tomorrow he is a better person, he can tomorrow have a greater knowledge. Therefore, man's power to know unfolds with himself. And that because of this, the individual in this world can never be absolutely certain unless he is absolutely perfect. And as perfection of this measure is a rarity, to say the least, there does not seem to be a superabundance of absolute knowledge. Ethically, we go into the next question, naturally. Is absolute knowledge necessary to a creature possessing only finite capacities? Is it necessary that the finite should understand the infinite? Probably it is not necessary. But it is part of man's ambition to overestimate himself, and out of a little knowledge to assume that he is worthy of a greater knowledge. But we do know certain things within the range of epistemological thinking. Namely, that knowledge can be increased in man to some degree in the course of even a single lifetime. We may say, therefore, that the child who has been to school has more knowledge than the infant. We may assume that the mature human being has more knowledge of some kind than the child, and that the person who has lived out his 40 years of a rich life of experience has more knowledge than a young person in their teens or 20s. All things being otherwise equal, we therefore say that there are two ways in which knowledge can be increased. First, by education, and second, by experience. These two forms, therefore, gradually increase the knowledge which the person possesses, but this increase is usually limited to a comparatively narrow area of material needs, responsibilities, or desires. The person experiencing material things becomes learned in them. An individual going to school becomes informed in the arts and sciences of his times and conditions. But it cannot be said that either of these persons has broken through the comparatively narrow boundaries of material knowing or material information. Epistemology then brings out the question, are there other ways of knowing? Epistemology does not say that knowledge has to be limited to education and experience. But it points out that these form a simple example of how knowledge can increase even upon one level of activity. Knowledge does not, however, transcend that level so long as it is related to the education and the experience of that level alone. Philosophy also points out that by certain interior attainments above the ordinary, based perhaps upon the advantages of being embodied with a more mature soul than that to be found in another person, certain individuals possess a greater degree of essential knowledge than others. By essential knowledge, we now mean knowledge which enriches life rather than merely enriches living. And knowledge by means of which the internal and eternal values of existence become more clearly comprehensible to consciousness itself. And the world has produced certain heroic persons, great religious leaders, great inspired teachers, of whom it may most reasonably be said that their knowledge of essential values has exceeded that of the average individual. It may not necessarily be said, however, that even the greatest of these has become all-knowing. Thus we observe that by various conditions, circumstances, or by various means, certain individuals have a larger allotment of essential knowledge. This essential knowledge they have conveyed to others. The transmission of this essential knowledge may be called higher learning. Higher now in the sense of deeper or richer learning. Higher in the sense of being beyond and above the common knowledge which we use in the performance of the various tasks of the day. Epistemology therefore points out that all these sources together may be said to constitute one grand part of knowledge. Knowledge arising from experience, knowledge arising from education, knowledge arising from contemplation and meditation and knowledge arising from the practices of rational disciplines within the person himself. Now, epistemology says, does this sum up the entire pattern of possible knowing? And it adds one other, a highly controversial factor, namely the possibility of knowledge from within the being itself. Knowledge conveyed or communicated by consciousness directly to the mind or to the outer faculties of man. This kind of knowledge has been termed illumination, the mystical experience, cosmic consciousness, or as some of the older mystical Christian writers called it, knowledge which is inspiration, or perhaps knowledge which is bestowed by God. This type of knowledge, epistemology acknowledges. It accepts that such type of knowledge is possible, but points out that by the very nature of it, it presents certain inevitable difficulties. Difficulties which can be cheerfully overlooked or even denied, but whether we deny them or overlook them, they still remain also factual and unchanging. The first problem of internal knowledge or inspiration, or we might say the grace of God conferring insight, this peculiar situation has to be judged again in terms of consequences, which are the only guides that we have. And we observe that so-called inner knowledge is not always in agreement. That individuals having visions, insight, mystical experiences are not always in agreement as to the facts resulting from these experiences. We know also that so-called intuitions and inspirations may or may not prove justified. We know that individuals claiming visions or peculiar insight have frequently been wrong. Therefore, we cannot say that these visions are inevitably true simply because they come from the inside of human consciousness. Psychology steps in here and points out that almost any mental or emotional attitude arising in man can be colored or discolored by the psychic interval through which it has to pass. Thus, we can say that empirically speaking, it is perfectly possible for an absolute knowledge to exist in the nature of God, and this knowledge to be revealed to a large degree, perhaps not absolutely, but to a degree beyond the ordinary communications of knowledge. And that this communication is possible by an inward experience called mystical, or of an illumination, or an enlightenment, or a spiritual attainment, by means of which the individual shares to an exalted degree insight into the realities of life. Epistemology covers this, affirming that it is possible, affirming that it has occurred, but not willing to commit itself as to whether even such experiences are absolute. In other words, whether it is possible, absolutely, for the finite or the conditioned fragments of which we call human consciousness to possess or to communicate, either from its own source to its own mind or from its own mind to other minds, the absolute knowledge of reality. The general tendency in this view has been to say that theoretically it is possible. Practically, it has not been known to occur. But as against this absolute factor, there has been a great deal of relative transmission of knowledge, vastly in excess of that commonly available to man. And there has been, undoubtedly, legitimate internal inspiration, illumination, and mystical insight arising from the nature of man himself. And it has also been assumed in epistemology that in practical consideration, by all the laws of reason, this knowledge coming from within or arising in the inner life of man is the most direct knowledge which man is capable of receiving, inasmuch as it has less losses through transmission, that it is also experienced immediately rather than merely being communicated, and that everything else being equal, experienced inner knowledge is more valid than communicated knowledge, which must pass through various channels to reach the sensory perceptions of the individual. So epistemology is concerned with all of these problems, but it is further also concerned with the practical application of the concepts of these problems. And I think in this phase, epistemology moves very close and into very intimate association with both Eastern and Western mysticism. If it does give us a vision or a concept of a universal process, it must, by virtue of philosophy itself, give us some insight as to how these ends can be attained, how the individual can increase in essential knowledge, how he can use knowledge more effectively in the maintenance of his own life, and perhaps with more understanding in relationship with other people. I believe that the first quality which epistemology is inclined to bestow is modesty, a most seemly and becoming virtue. Modesty arising in this science is based upon the extraordinary difficulties attendant upon essential knowledge. Therefore, that the probabilities that as one individual has it in greater abundance than another, these such probabilities are relative rather than absolute. Epistemology teaches us, first of all, not that others are probably wrong, but perhaps that we ourselves are probably wrong, that we cannot dogmatize, that the individual who makes unconditioned, unqualified assertions of abstractions is not true simply because he makes such assertions, that anyone can assert, but that the only one who is able to be sure is a person whose total knowledge, whose total consciousness has been greatly elevated. In the Western systems, the mysteries sought to communicate the laws of such elevation. And in the Eastern mystical systems, Buddhism, Vedanta, and Yoga have attempted to achieve the same end. All knowledge, whether it comes from inside or outside, is subject to the damage wrought by the psychic integration or disintegration of the individual. An individual under intense psychic pressure reduces the probability of their ability to possess essential knowledge. Regardless of what they know, the purest dream of knowledge is disfigured by their own intensity. An individual in whose nature hatred or greed or avarice or intemperance or intolerance strongly exist, such a person is incapable of a clear channel for the dissemination of essential knowledge. Knowledge cannot escape the contamination of the instruments through which it passes. Therefore, a knowledge which in its substance and in its essence may be beautiful is profaned to become a tyrannical error if the instrument through which it passes lacks grace of spirit and insight and tenderness and gentleness and charity. So it was assumed by all ancient peoples that the most important of all channels for the communication of knowledge is the internal channel. That knowledge is communicated, essential knowledge, most directly between consciousness and the mind, and finally through the sensory perceptions of the individual himself. But what we call the psychic focus is therefore the point where knowledge, moving from its invisible causes, flows into visible expression in some form. Either it is put into thoughts, or into words, or into forms and colors, or into formulas of one kind or another. But this knowledge is always moving through the psychic integration of the person. And if this integration is poor, the consequence must be inadequate. So the ancient system sought to purify the channels of this communication. It was assumed that if the individual was able to completely disentangle self-interest from knowledge, then he would be in the most favorable condition to possess true knowing. If, however, self-interest of any kind existed, it threatened the integrity of essential knowledge. Thus, while knowledge from within is the most pure in principle, knowledge from the outside is often the most effective in practice. For example, the individual, under the normal conditions of life, may never be able to intuit or gain from within himself as clear a concept of knowledge as he can read from Socrates. Not because he couldn't, but because he lacked the integration which made possible the communication of this knowledge. He even lacks the thought forms by means of which he could embody this knowledge in practical ideas. He lacks the ability to rationalize the very impulses of knowledge that might come to him. Therefore, while it is true that the mystic, in a pure state of subjective insight, can receive a pure stream of knowledge more clearly, more intimately, more immediately than he can ever receive it from the outside, this is not true of the average person. It is not true of the average person because he lacks a trained instrument. Now, we may say that when someone like Socrates puts his thoughts into words, and these words are translated into another language, and we finally read them, that there have been many opportunities for errors to creep in, that we are far removed from even Socrates as a basic source of knowledge. This is true. But it also remains true that human experience has shown us that even with these restrictions, limitations, and imperfections, the average person living the average kind of life and with the average degree of internal development cannot equal, of his own thinking, the wisdom of Socrates. He simply is not able to do it. He lacks the internal development which makes this possible. Therefore, it is sometimes better for man to choose a good teacher from the outside until he is able to integrate his own psychic organism, until he is able to find that perfect temperance of the soul, which the ancients called the climate of enlightenment. While this individual is subject to temper fits, depressions, spells and attitudes of intemperance, of an intemperate nature, is burdened with innumerable fixations and problems of this world, solve none of the immediate and environmental situations that confront him every day. Such a person is in no condition to receive a pure stream of inspiration. Now, the answer to that one also presents another question in epistemology, namely the experience that we sometimes seem to have, as in the case of Paul of Tarsus, where an individual with practically no known virtues was the recipient of a divine revelation, and that Paul received the vision of Christ when many of the most pious and sincere of the Christ followers never had any such vision given to them. And yet Paul at that time was on his way to persecute the Master. I think the answer to this has to lie in a chemistry which we cannot solve in a one-life theory. The experience that came to Paul came as the result, undoubtedly, of a long previous record of karma. Actually, Paul was a sincere man. He was doing what he believed. He had not apparently, in this embodiment, at that time, reached the point in which he could transcend the material elements of his personality and received the full psychic maturity which he had brought with him from a past life. Whereas man matures physically and intellectually, say around his 21st year, the average person does not mature psychically till they're at least 30. Therefore, Paul had not picked up his own insight. He had not revived the pattern of his own previous merits as they had been built up. And it was when he received this maturity of his psychic life that he suddenly realized his mistake and repented of it genuinely and sincerely for the rest of his life. But even prior to that, I think the records all indicate that he was a very sincere person doing that which he believed to be right. And this was important in his karma. Now, in the same way, under certain conditions, individuals who apparently have very little claim to spiritual maturity have apparently had authentic spiritual revelation. Epistemology faces this problem also. It points out certain conditions which can arise within the life of the individual, conditions which have to be lawful, even though we cannot fully understand them. One of the problems that seems to play a factor in this is that very often psychic or mystical revelations are found among comparatively simple and untutored people. This may be partly due to the fact that these individuals have not develop the tremendous materialistic intensities which dominate the life of other more sophisticated individuals. Therefore, the simple, the meek, those of extremely humble nature, seemingly are peculiarly suited to receive visions and mystical experiences. Perhaps it is because these simple people have very little selfishness in them. They have never really thought of building a tremendous personal sophistication. I think that was true of Baby, a very simple, pious man who never for a moment questioned the simple faith that he held. He tried to live it. He lived a simple life as a shoemaker. And perhaps by his very detachment from the illusionary pressures that mark more sophisticated existence, he was an available channel. And this availability, again, probably goes back to psychic maturity at a past time. Altogether, in all probabilities, where illumination or the mystical experience seems to strike a person whose qualifications are not obvious to us, I think we have to recognize with the ancients that these things rest with a karmic law that goes back over a very long period of time. That the working of this karmic law may or may not be obvious to anyone studying merely the external personalities of these individuals. Epistemology also goes into the nature of essential knowledge as to what it is. What is the most essential knowledge that we can conceive of? And I think the only answer that we can positively say to that is that the most essential knowledge is to know that there is a universal or divine plan. That essential knowledge is to know with absolute certainty the power that governs the world and the purposes of that power. From that point on, all growth lies not in knowledge but in obedience. And knowledge must be the basis of enlightened obedience. We cannot obey efficiently or practically that which we do not know. This is the excuse for knowledge. This is why epistemology is important, is that it must provide the individual with the facts needed for the direction of his own conduct in action. If this knowledge is not available, then the individual cannot direct his own life. So the nature of knowledge, the possibility of the attainment of knowledge, and the substance of that to be known, all of these become moral forces in the life of man in his evolutionary growth. Today, we have very largely theoretical knowledge. Therefore, we have many beliefs that are accepted but are not known. We have some beliefs that are acknowledged but not vitally followed, simply because the individual has not experienced any vitality in these beliefs. As a result of this alone, we have hundreds of millions of nominal members of religious groups who are not practicing their religious beliefs. They may to some degree be trying, but there is no energy in this. There is no libido behind it, because this doctrine, this creed, this code is simply something that has been imparted to them. It is something held in common by many members of a sect. It has never been vitalized by any internal experience. It has never taken on the form or quality of essential knowledge. We therefore can go against our opinions or go against the opinions of others with very little hesitation. But it is extremely difficult to go against that which we internally know by experience. Experience must ultimately convert us all. And experience is either a man's intuitive, psychic recognition of truths as a result of the daily processes of life, or experience is man's participation in an overstate of knowing through visions, through inspiration, through intuition, or other extrasensory perceptions. Such knowledge as is derived from the internal has the greater authority, but also presents the greater hazard because we do not know what level this inspiration has touched. We are not sure that it has reached into the core of things. It may only be a psychological pressure arising from some willful purpose of our own, some determination to achieve a goal which is not universally appropriate. So we have to be extremely careful in the estimation of this type of revelation. But it does occur, and all the things being equal, internal experience is the most powerful of all forces. In most religious systems of antiquity, religious experience of this nature, as in Zen and in other Eastern sects, was a result of dedication and discipline. The individual gradually grew in the capacity to receive inner light. He placed his life under the most rigid controls. He detached himself from all artificial or unreasonable pursuits. He simplified his conduct in every way possible. He did not necessarily renounce the world, but he certainly renounced worldliness as a force within himself. He sought to moderate all desires and appetites, and most of all to direct his attention most forcibly and continuously towards those noblest aims and ends which were appropriate. He sought to increase knowledge of all useful arts and sciences. He sought to build all of the intellectual and moral strength that he could so that this could support his spiritual endeavor. Most of all, perhaps, in all these processes, he sought for the gradual renunciation of the sense of selfness. He sought to leave behind, as far as he could, all purposes which might be regarded as self-motivated. He no longer wished to succeed. He no longer feared to fail. He no longer worried about pride. He no longer had any competitive instincts about knowing. His only desire to know was based upon his simple desire to obey the laws of God. When he desired only to obey, to acknowledge, to venerate, when his one and only purpose was to fulfill that which deity desired, and he had no human equation left, then, as Plotinus tells us, he approaches divinity. He makes the necessary requirements in his own life. And usually, where we are dealing with mystical experiences, we have a right to examine these factors. And the individual who believes that he has a valid experience must, to some measure, estimate his own character as to whether, so far as he knows, he is a valid person, whether he is entitled to such experience, whether his own life justifies his receiving a greater knowledge than he presently possesses. If he is not using well what he knows already, there seems to be little reason why he needs more. If he fails in the common things, there is no good reason why he should share in uncommon things. If he has not been able to make his obvious life a more orderly and better managed experience, there is no reason to assume that he is in need of extraordinary faculties or powers. So all things have, as the philosophy points out, a reasonableness in them. And epistemology is therefore not only the science of knowledge, it is the science of the reasonableness of becoming able to know. The science of the reasonableness of who knowledge, of whom will receive knowledge, how it will be given, what its laws are, how knowledge administers its own estate, and how knowledge, in the proper and full course of things, becomes the inevitable birthright of every living thing. These are the various phases and departments of epistemology. And through the consideration of them, simply, directly, and honestly, I think we can find that this branch of philosophy makes a valid contribution to our general improvement. Well, I think that's all for this evening. I'll take my sniffles home.